Excellent. An ale for me. And for my officers. In fact, ales for everyone.
Oh. Turn backwards. Rick and work. And Will.
Oh, yes.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Ten Backward, a podcast from merry old England. I'm Richard and I'm joined by my friends Rick.
Hello, good evening.
And Will.
All right.
Each episode we pick a topic to talk about, and this time around it is the film Star Trek V, the much maligned, it would seem, film of the franchise, but one we have looked at. And we want to address whether it deserves that malignment. Is that malignment a word?
It is now.
Whether it deserves that reputation.
We'll add it to clean time travel and things that we invented that should be words.
Right. Yeah. And we ourselves have, when we talked about what we consider to be the worst film, we've even said that Five is the... it's the stinkiest.
Yeah, but is that a memory that's been implanted into our minds willingly?
Yeah.
Are we victims of peer pressure?
I think, you know what? I think
maybe
cool I am.
Because the cool kids said that Star Trek V was one of the worst.
Right.
Have we just gone with that?
I think I've just... maybe I have. I will admit it right now. So yeah, so Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, it was released in 1989. It was directed by William Shatner.
Yeah.
I've heard of him.
Screenplay was by David Lochery. Lowery?
Yeah.
And it was based on a story written by David Lowery, Harve Bennett, and William Shatner. So, guys, do you want to... You've taken more copious notes than I think I have, so I think I'll hand it over to you to carry this forward.
So I think, first of all, we should talk about why is Star Trek V considered to be the worst of the Star Trek movies? Why does it earn that reputation?
I think it's because it set itself a very difficult story that it's going to find God.
Mm.
And I think that's a very, very difficult thing to have, because you're going to offend people. It's a very controversial, touchy subject, religion. It's going to be, in some way, shape or form, pretty anticlimactic. Because if you find God, well, where the hell do you go from there? And if you find something that's pretending to be God, that's kind of a whole different thing, and actually, again, a bit anticlimactic, because you're going to find God. So it's a very, very difficult story to set and actually have in, you know, in any way that's satisfying to everyone.
Is it any kind of described as God by Captain Kirk? Is it mentioned as that? Because it's Shakari, isn't it?
No, Cyborg says, we're going to see God. He waits for us beyond the barrier.
Right, okay. Mm.
I think that's about the point. He's trying to convince Kirk that he's not a crazy person, and Kirk immediately has his beat-off expression and says, I'm not convinced that you're not a crazy person. So,
because there's a famous line of, what does God need with a starship?
Yes. But, the being they've encountered presents himself as God. Cyborg is on the hunt for God. They're going to essentially heaven or Eden, Vortivore, Shakari, whatever term, you know, it talks about a common thread in beliefs and religions, that there's an almighty and there's a paradise sort of thing. And yeah, this is obviously mirrored with the Ferengi, as we previously discussed. They have a spiritual side.
But I think, like you say, it's sort of a tough sell from the outset. So in a sort of one-line synopsis, you know, Star Trek IV, the crew go back in time to the 80s.
Save
comedy
the
ensues. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek II, the figure from Kirk's past comes back to confront. Oh, that's an awfully unconcise. but there is a concise way to sum up that. You know, it's kind of a revenge story.
Maybe
it's a one-on-one battle. Yes, yes,
yes,
that's it.
A very
yeah.
good concise. Right.
That's what I was trying to say.
What would your concise one-line summary for the motion picture be?
Boring.
But again, we're dealing with the search for a higher being.
Mm.
And that's, you know, this thing comes out looking for its creator. And Roddenberry wrote that as a thing on why humans don't need to believe in God.
I did read that. There's a connection between... Roddenberry had a story which became the motion picture, but that idea of that story also influences this film.
I'd read that as well, yeah. And was it, I can't remember what he called it, it was something like the God thing.
Yes. That was, I think, yeah. Roddenberry's title when he was developing it as a pilot for the Phase 2 series.
Mm.
Then when the plans for that were scrapped and went to movie, they essentially took that pilot script and tried to big it up into a movie. With, you know, and taking influence from the big sci-fi hits of the time, like 2001 and Close Encounters.
Did Roddenberry write The Changeling?
I don't know if he wrote it directly. I don't think he directly wrote it, but he rewrote a lot.
The Changeling's very similar to
there's about, yes.
Motion Picture, yeah. As well, isn't it? Mm. Like an Earth technology colliding with alien technology, yeah. And forming an entity.
But certainly I believe that it was felt by Roddenberry and some close to him that what Shatner had done with Five was take Roddenberry's story and try and do it himself. And so, and there was some very bad feeling over it. Potential lawsuit at one point, I believe.
Okay.
Stuff I've looked at. So, but I don't know whether Shatner was deliberately doing that or he just had an idea and there tend to be a bit of coincidental overlap.
Ego wars, maybe.
Yeah.
He said he was influenced by televangelists, people who Shatner did. He said he'd seen some people on the TV. They were sort of.
Sorry.
What was that?
I think that's my phone detecting some kind of something.
Something. Subspace anomaly, maybe.
Yeah. I've lost my thread completely.
Sorry about that, man.
Yeah, right. So yeah, Shatner. Seeing televangelists on the TV,
yes,
and
that was
his inspiration for
the cyborg
character.
Yeah, the guy who, you know, developed a big following and everyone gave him the devotion and he said he could bring them closer to God, and that was kind of the scope
he was
going for.
He can do that, though. He does genuinely he does genuinely do something to people. When, in that opening scene in the opening scene on Nimbus 3 which really reminded me of Mad Max, I have to admit, guy in the desert, the kind of hole farmer, he's got holes in the sand, he's looking in holes, and Cyborg turns up and relieves him of his, he kind of helps him confront his pain, doesn't he?
He does.
That's not flim-flam.
Everyone
do that.
Benefits him. But they are then sort of slavishly devoted to him. Even Enterprise crew members are, to an extent. And it's kind of a bit like, what does he do? Is there some aspect of the mind meld that he's using to do this?
Because it's never satisfyingly
explained.
Yeah. But in my head canon, it's kind of an extension of.
Mm.
It feels like Cyborg has researched and understood kind of mind melds and that sort of Vulcan.
I guess maybe most beings have to repress the things that you have to repress the things that cause you suffering in order to cope in a normal life. But eventually, that will only allow you to survive. It won't allow you to flourish.
Mm.
So in order to flourish, it's like I don't know, there's a lot, I imagine there's a lot of psychology which goes into confronting your pain, the things that you suppress. Rather than a mind meld, I think maybe it's just some kind of, it's similar, but maybe it's just something where you allow somebody to safely confront their pain rather than suppress it, because it's easier to ignore it than to deal with it.
I think the novelization goes some way in trying to explain it, and it does use the mind meld as a more of a overt thing that he does. And I feel that when someone's carrying that level of emotional baggage, that probably what Cyborg is doing is a temporary or quick fix at best. And I think there must be a certain amount of undue influence, because people then just fall behind his banner so quickly. And I don't think that Starfleet officers like Sulu and Uhura would throw aside years of duty and training so quickly like that. So I think there must be a level of control exerted. But I just feel like it's not really addressed.
Yeah.
And it's kind of left a bit hanging. It's like, what was it? Because the god turns out to be fake. So what has Cyborg been doing? And where was that?
One inconsistency I found with the film is with Cyborg's powers is that so he does have an influence over certain crew members on the Enterprise, like you say, Uhura and Scotty and Sulu are all are all sort of taken in. But wait, not Scotty.
Not Scotty. No.
But not Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. They kind of go through a whole thing with him, and they're basically unchanged. So why doesn't that work on some people, but it does on others?
It's like a half developed idea. If you wrote that idea on paper, you would say this looks like a great idea, but then you have to flesh it out.
Yeah.
You have to go into it and go, mm-hmm. how this
well
work?
The original idea in the script was that Bones and Spock also would be taken in by Cyborg, and Kirk would kind of be on his own, but then Nimoy and DeForest Kelly challenged that and said they'd never, you know, these characters wouldn't do that. They wouldn't side with this guy.
And William Shatner tried to talk to Nimoy about that, didn't he? Tried to convince him to kind of go with it. Which is fair enough.
I think that changed. It feels evident. You can see that in the script that change came, and it doesn't quite.
I find it interesting that during that sequence, we have McCoy first, and he brings to forth this bit with the death of his father, the euthanasia section, and then we address Spock and his birth and Sarek's immediate rejection of his son, and then we don't have time for Kirk because we're at the Great Barrier, so he goes to leave. McCoy goes to follow, and then they realise Spock isn't coming, and Spock says something along the lines of,
"I am not the outcast boy you left behind those many years ago. Since that time, I have found myself and my place. I know who I am."
And I kind of think, well, actually then, did Cyborg get sloppy with Spock? Did he, in fact, address the pain he assumed Spock had and not the pain that he actually has, if any? And did he think that Spock... Did he think Spock had a pain where Spock has, in fact, become more comfortable with who he is and addressed these things in his own way? And so he made that flaw, and then because once Spock was behind, McCoy knew his loyalty laid in that triad of those three, well beyond Cyborg, regardless of his pain relief, mind melts or whatever. And I think, and again, it's just something I'd like to have seen a little bit more fleshed out.
I have to admit, I think Cyborg, maybe not this story, but that character, he seems perfect for the Kelvinverse. He seems like an intelligent villain.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have to resolve it with punching.
No,
and it's an underdone story that we got first time around. So I think Cyborg would be a great character to see again. I would like to see him again. I think what we're touching on is that this story is just the story's fine. It's just not finalized well.
It's not finished
because they touch on lots of things. I mean Cyborg is essentially, he's a cult leader, I guess. He knows how best to help you have a better life, but in order to do that you have to kind of give up your independence, your ability, your right to choose what's best for you. He's the person that chooses what's best for you, but it never really kind of goes anywhere with that. We see him with an army of people on Nimbus 3 taking over Paradise City, where the grass isn't green but the girls are quite pretty. Please take me home. I'm guessing that those people go up to the, do they go up to the Enterprise when they take it over?
There's a big crowd of them.
They take it over quite quickly. All that, it's not. I want to say it's rushed. It's just.
They do state early on. It's a bit of a throwaway line, but they do say something along the lines of they haven't got a full crew.
Doesn't anything work on this ship? Starfleet's got some nerve sending us out in this condition with this handful of people.
So
yes, it's in. Is it back in space after its shakedown?
Yes,
right.
A lot of crew on it. So they've basically recalled the senior staff. They've got probably a few other people, mainly technicians, helping Scotty with the repairs.
Yeah,
the thing. Well, that's, I'm going to take issue because the very early on you see this cut. They pan to space dock, and then you get Scotty's engineer's log. Yeah. And as you the engineers log.
I think it's been made by monkeys, he says.
The camera goes over the top of Excelsior's saucer to show Enterprise. So Excelsior sat right there.
Yeah.
Enterprise is not the only ship in range, and quite honestly, they could just recall the crew and stick them on the Excelsior for this mission while Enterprise gets repaired.
Yeah,
But, you know, Starfleet does not always think these things through logically. Basically, Starfleet's upper command structure needs more Vulcans to think these things through logically, because humans are making silly decisions. Another downside I had listed... It's the effects.
Yes, yes.
Now, I don't want to like trash the whole movie because of the effects. You know, they are not the be all and end all.
Yeah.
But ILM had done some sterling work in Star Trek 2 and 3. And I don't know, did they do 4? I think they might have done 4.
I think they did.
I'm not looking up, I'm being lazy.
I think they'd done all of they'd done 2, 3 and 4, I'm sure.
So there's a very set style and a very good look to it that had already been established. And then, because as we touched on, that summer was the summer of massive blockbusters, and I think ILM were caught up already working on 2 movies.
Yeah, I think Last Crusade was one of them, and that was a massive undertaking for them.
So basically they had no scope to do 5.
Yeah,
and the effects nice they got in were not as good, and it did show, it suffered. There was a lot of stop motion
gun.
Yeah, and it's because they couldn't get the usual motion control stuff to work, so they had to resort to stop motion, and they hadn't meant to. But they also only had 3 months to do the effects, which apparently is half the time that you usually have.
So maybe they're already too harsh on them because there was other constraints.
Yeah.
Again, this is the whole thing. It's like it was rushed, it was pushed through, there was budget, you know, it's not quite finished.
That's it.
You kind of think if someone could give them a few more million dollars to go back and just finish some bits off. I know you can't refilm scenes at this point now because everyone's aged, it'd be ridiculous, but just like this just needs a little bit more love and work on that film.
At least they didn't have a scene where they just didn't bother, like in Insurrection with the Collector, where they just had the blue screens on because they couldn't do the space background that they wanted to.
Yeah, or they just decided they...
Somewhere there's going to be an alien race that just likes blue backdrops and their
walls.
Well,
you know, maybe, but still.
It's just coincidence that that's a special effects chroma key thing.
I didn't mind the stop motion. I quite like stop motion stuff. I can see how it is jarring, but
it's jarring in terms of
like
the style established.
It's like in Conspiracy when you see the little kind of space parasite.
Yeah,
the stop motion walk up the guy's arm and go. It doesn't look great, but there's part of you that goes, I do like stop motion work.
Yeah, but where the effects do really impact the film, I think, is the whole end sequence, and that impacted the story because originally the idea was, but I think when it was conceived that God was going to actually turn out to be Satan. I think this was Chatner's idea, and then everyone was going to be
blaming
taken down to hell, and Shatner was going to save everyone from the devil. But then this got changed into it's not God; it's an entity that says it's God. So there were going to be some demons that came up, and instead these got changed to rock monsters, so that they weren't demons because they didn't want to associate the creature with Satan.
Yeah, they did tread carefully, I think, on that, didn't they?
Yeah, and I'd read originally there were going to be 10 of these sort of rock monsters that were going to chase down Kirk. Then they got down to 6, and then they talked Shatner down to just 1 because 1 was all they could deliver, and then that 1 didn't work. And I'd read that they filmed loads of scenes with this rock monster. And it was meant to... It didn't look very good, but they could get loads of smoke to come out of it to sort of disguise the fact that it was a dude in a rubber suit. But that stopped working on the last day of filming, and so there's a load of shots where it's just exposed and you can tell it's just a guy in a suit, and they just couldn't use those effects. And so the whole ending is changed. And that's why it kind of feels anticlimactic. And
I think they should think about it. In the original series where Trek's fighting the Gorn, that's clearly I don't know. I mean, that's a real
but that's different. Weekly TV in the 60s, guess, and this is a movie in the late 80s.
You've already seen effects in 4 and 3 and 2 that surpass that. So I guess that's why. I think, you know, they took the decision that those effects weren't going
to
work.
I mean, in 4, they made model whales that caused animal rights groups to criticise them for filming real whales that closely.
But
we didn't. They're models. And then you get those issues.
So. Greenpeace.
But so it does. Another thing I find is some of the there's comedic elements that I find are a little bit slapstick.
Yeah, and excessive. I know that there's a one particular bit.
I think we're probably thinking the same one.
It's the Scotty. It's
I
the
know
Scotty.
This ship like the back of my
like
hand.
The back of my hand.
Clung.
Nothing amazing about it. I know this ship like the back of my hand.
Oh, I mean the back of... Oh, what's this? What's this?
It just demeans Scotty.
I don't remember that more.
Yeah.
It just demeans Scotty, I think, a little bit. I know it's supposed to be a funny moment and stuff, but this just Shatner's humour is different, I think, a little way. There's been... And actually, he was under a studio edict to make this light-hearted because of how well 4 had done.
That's what I'd written. In the original version, the script was actually really dark and serious,
I think at some point, you find that tonally, this movie's a little bit all over the place.
Yeah.
There are bits that are dark, there are bits that are slapstick, and it's difficult to reconcile the two. Again, it's something that could be smoothed over with another script polish. And again, it's like just feels unfinished.
Yeah. And there was a writer's strike in 1989.
Help,
And I think that they... Because it feels like... Yeah, like we said, there should have been a few more drafts of the script.
Should have got some scabs in to finish the writing.
Yeah. I've noted down... the Klingons are the bad guys again? For what reason?
That B story?
They just show up like the Nazis do in Indiana Jones.
No,
they're like a kind of a
actually. Consider...
Hey, wait, the Nazis were after the Ark of the Covenant.
Consider the events of 3 and 4, though. After the whole incident over Genesis, and in 4, you've got the Klingon ambassador saying, you know, condemning Kirk as a criminal for his actions, and saying there'll be no peace while Kirk lives. And I think that's... And McCoy actually references to Kirk. We're bound to bump into the Klingons, and they don't exactly like you. And Kirk's quite a sort of bitter at all. Her feelings mutual. Again, not expanded on. There's meaning there, but only if you're aware of it. And I kind of think that you have to consider again, is this something that was meant to be a continuation of that storyline?
Yeah, maybe.
Is this the Klingons are after... I mean, I've got some things about Klar.
Yeah.
I like him. I like him and I like Vixis, the Klingon commander and his first officer. They are really cool. But I also feel that he would be an appropriate opponent for a younger captain. I kind of feel like Kirk at this point needs someone who's got a little bit of experience, a little bit of wisdom, and a little bit of...
Yeah, that's right. He's young and cocky, and he's just out for glory, isn't he?
Kirk now is very seasoned, very experienced.
Very seasoned.
Stuff. And, you know, it's just like, well, that's like sending a kid up against him, essentially, isn't it? And it's like, I think it does Kirk a disservice for this guy to be his enemy. And I think it's this guy a disservice to go up against Kirk, because no one believes you're going to win. So I don't feel that Clark comes off as threatening as he would have if he'd been, I mean, a Klingon like Clark versus Archer maybe would have worked. Or another captain. But yeah, I don't know whether Shatner was trying to get a sort of a young sexy cast thing going on. I don't know. I just feel it's a poor match adversary to hero.
It just felt like to me it's yet another movie where the Klingons are the bad guys, and if you go back to the original series, the Klingons don't show up all that much. In the movie universe, in the original series movies, the Klingons just it feels like they're not really very developed characters.
I think it's more about the characterization and the way that, as I say, maybe they're a mismatch. So I'm going to assume that you don't hate Undiscovered Country.
I do not hate
Klingons
it.
Klingons turned up
I
in there.
Love it. Yeah, that's true. So, that's
I've
true.
Been here all this time and I love that film.
Do you have any more downsides of five?
We've already talked a bit about Cybok. As we get onto the things that we really like about it, I think Cybok's a genuinely interesting character.
I'd love to know more about it.
I don't think he's a strong villain, and I think that kind of hurts the film in the way that there isn't a great adversary to go up against until maybe the last sort of 10 minutes when they meet God. Because there's a point where Cybok kind of becomes a guy that you're with and they sort of make their peace with him.
And he does actually sacrifice himself to help the rest of them.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I'd argue by the end he's not really a bad guy at all. But then that means the film loses a bit of direction in that sense.
There's not kind of anybody he dislikes. There's not an enemy.
Hmm. Yeah,
most cult leaders they'll engage you by saying, this is my idea, this is what's going on, this is what's wrong with the world. I'll make your life better for you. So they direct someone's problems to somewhere else.
Yeah.
So if he'd kind of done that, if he'd done that to attack something, or if he was a misguided cult leader, then. But that would be a completely different film, I guess.
I think he is kind of a misguided.
He is, yeah.
Cult leader. He is a misguided cult leader, but he's not. But he isn't. It's not a cult where it's about it kind of blame. There's no enemy in his cult. There's no adversarial figure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's true. Then the cult isn't
so
sort
of
against
cults,
anyone.
Lots of cults kind of. Like say, this is why the main world is wrong.
Right.
Kind of come and live under my protection. And I'll look after you.
Yeah.
I know the best way for you to live. And you kind of you surrender your independence, and that's how a cult works.
Yeah.
But he doesn't do that. He doesn't attack anybody really. Like he takes over Paradise City.
He kind of uses violence, but he's also slightly horrified by violence.
He attacks. Mars Eisley, sort of.
Yeah.
He's like an absolute
shit. He's already
a
high scum villain.
Cell. Come and live with me where it'd be cool.
Yeah.
There's a lady who's Romulan that doesn't seem like a Romulan at all.
Yeah.
She has a backstory that wasn't in the film.
Okay.
But, Caitlin is obviously not a Romulan name. So I think apparently she had a human grandfather. Is the novelisation thing about it. I don't know whether that was always intended.
There was the Earth Romulan War, so that could have happened.
Yeah. But she doesn't look or act like a bumper racket.
There's St. John Johnson III, played by David Warner.
St. John Talbot.
St. John Talbot.
Yeah.
Can I go back a little bit on the Klingon guy, Klar?
No, you cannot.
There's a note here that I didn't read out, and I thought it was quite an interesting idea.
Well, it's too late.
Well, I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah. I just feel that maybe he would have been a more menacing opponent instead of trying to go up against Kirk all the time. While Kirk and Spock and McCoy are on the planet, if Chekhov had remained in command and there'd been more of a face-off Chekhov-Klar.
Mm.
So I think to Chekhov and Klar, that would have been a much better adversarial relationship.
That would have been something we'd not seen before as well.
Yeah.
And that would have been, yeah.
So that's just a thought I was having, but I thought it was worth mentioning. Have we got any more downsides to?
I've got one more, but it's kind of a nitpick, and it's about the Great Barrier.
Okay.
I think it's unfair to. So the idea is that at the centre of the universe there's a Great Barrier and no one can go beyond it.
Mm.
And I listened to the director's commentary on it. Well, it's not the director's commentary; it's a commentary done by some people who are involved in the film, but in a non-specific way. But they talk about how
William Shatner's coffee.
Yeah. So at the time, it wasn't. Generally, now it's accepted that the theory around what's in the centre of the universe, or the centre of the universe, centre of the
galaxy
is a supermassive black hole.
Mm.
In 1989, when the film was made, this wasn't known. It wasn't kind of considered the accepted science. So the idea of there being a great barrier in the centre of the galaxy wasn't that silly an idea. And it's unfair to maybe criticise the film for some science that there wasn't out there yet.
Have they proven that there is a supermassive black hole at the centre of the galaxy?
Don't think they've proven it, but it's...
Because they're still trying to work out...
That's more consistent with current observations, though, isn't
it? Yeah.
But they're still trying to work out how the universe is expanding at the rate it is. They're always... I know what you mean. I think it's just... I know... Maybe in the Star Trek world, that does exist.
Yeah, what they say in the commentary is, what if there is a supermassive black hole in the centre of the galaxy, but there's also a great barrier, and maybe you go through the barrier, and then maybe the planet that they find beyond there is sort of caught in the gravity well of this supermassive black hole. You know, maybe that still works. But
your nitpick with real science is one thing, but there's also the nitpick with established Star Trek thing that the centre of the galaxy is actually well out of reach.
Right, yeah, but yeah.
Then Sulu says, on course at warp 7, about 2 hours till we get there.
Yeah.
What?
I guess the galaxy is pretty small then.
From the edge of Romulan border, whoosh, to the centre of the galaxy. I don't know what the hell engines they put on the Enterprise. I mean, I know Scotty said there was a good set of engines.
Light years, right?
Well, yeah, I mean,
Voyager must have been going pretty slow if it was going to take them 70 years.
They were always dicking around helping people with their planets getting bombarded by meteorites.
Yeah. But another nitpick around the Great Barrier is they make a big point about how no ships have ever made it through or been heard from since. And then they get to the Great Barrier and just go through it, everything's fine.
Again, now, the novelisation contains details that Cyborg had invented shield modifications.
I knew you were going to say that.
And I think there was something about engine modifications so they could get there faster.
Yeah.
Again, it's like a few lines of dialogue could have sort of gone
right, yeah.
Sorted all that out.
It's just, yeah. I agree.
There's a scene in the novel where Klar on the Klingon Bird of Prey has scanned Enterprise's shields and copied the modifications so he can pass through too.
Yeah.
So it's all like...
It's all they would have needed to kind of to get rid of that nit. But I think it's not just a nitpick. It's a bit of a hole. If you've established that you no ship can pass through this barrier and it's a big deal and Cyborg steals a ship to go to the Great Barrier, then you just go through it and everything's fine.
We could have just said it was this weird phenomena that was randomly placed in a bit of the galaxy they had... That was quite close to where they were, and they tried sending ships through and probes, never worked out, and so people, essentially, all the races had stuck a big old "do not enter" sign on there.
Yeah.
Cyborg had figured the shield thing out. You know, a few seconds of dialogue would have been sorted.
Yeah, definitely, and it's so. It's frustrating because it didn't need to be a nitpick, but it is.
That's fair enough.
But so I think I think we've kind of established all the things that most of the things that are considered to be pretty poor about fire. And a lot of them are valid.
If you're going to have a story where you essentially have a character who thinks they can meet God and knows where he is, that story has to be well worked out.
Yeah, I think.
Like, it can't be something that you do on the fly. You have to kind of acknowledge how that story, in many ways, wouldn't make sense. Or if it does make sense, then you have to explain lots of stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
And they didn't have the time to do that. They had to.
They had to cobble together a script and get a film out. And it feels
Shatner
like
was
sort of
arguing with Roddenberry, or I read that maybe Roddenberry's secretary was bad-mouthing William Shatner to Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, apparently she was really going around saying he's copied the idea and he's an asshole.
Bill's a bastard.
Yeah,
the line I heard.
And Shatner's direction isn't considered to be.
I think it's all right.
I agree.
Sorry,
but, yeah,
I don't.
But,
I don't find any issue in that terms. I just find the issue with the just the slightly unfinished nature of the story. Shall we start? Shall we run through some pros?
I think we should, because I think we've touched on pros even going into the bad. I think we're itching to hit the pros because let's be honest, we've all talked about between ourselves how we each revisited this film without high expectations, and we all had a lovely time watching it.
We did. I really liked some of the sets. I liked the new bridge.
Mm.
I think it was a really nice attempt to bridge, no pun intended, the look of the original to next gen. Mm. They sort of carpeted, they adapted a more touchscreen look with the displays.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of that was reversed a little bit for 6 under Nick Mayer's direction, but I still think that bridge looked nice.
And what's interesting about that is it was from, I learned from the commentary, that was a rushed together, unplanned, unbudgeted for addition to the film. They thought they had a bridge set they were going to use. And
unfortunately,
they couldn't.
I think Next Gen had cannibalised it so many times.
Yeah.
For the battle bridge and lab sets and all sorts. They were, they had no chance. So they had to rush that together pretty quick.
Yeah, and I agree. I like the look of it. It's fine.
Richard has already touched on David Warner as St. John Talbot. It's just David Warner.
Yeah,
that's
an
immediate point in the plus column, isn't it? David Warner's in it.
Agreed. He doesn't get a lot of screen time, but
apparently he had a lot more stuff to do originally, but a lot of it got cut. I don't know whether it was cut from the script or cut from the filmed material, but he's excellent. Nimbus 3, I just quite like the concept of this planet where all three governments had decided to jointly administer.
Even just the opening scene where there's this guy in this desert and Cyborg comes out of the kind of heat wave, the dust and the heat of this planet, and that opening scene with that guy where he offers, it kind of sums up what you can do.
And I think it's a touch of what DS9 gets to, in that what this planet has not worked out, the vaunted Federation paradise has not worked here.
Because
I'd love to know more. I think it's ripe for expansion. What other stories could take place here?
What went wrong?
Yeah,
definitely something that Star Trek Discovery could go into.
And it's a shame, but I've done some looking, memory beta and stuff, and there doesn't seem to be any expanded universe stuff for Nimbus outside of, I think there's a set of missions you can play on Star Trek Online on Nimbus 3. But there isn't anything much else, and I think it's ripe for some expansion because it's a really interesting concept.
I guess it's a planet that's equidistant between each of the main powers, and it's a meeting place. Well, it was intended as one, and then 20 years down the line, it's Mos Eisley.
I'd love to know. Was there other conflicts that made the powers take that out? Was there an internal squabble? Was one part? Was it more the Romulan fault, or was it more the Federation? Who did what? And in the end, we see it, and it's where it's like literally a dumping ground for people whose ambassadorial careers are not up to much, and the Federation would rather have them out with the way where they can't be embarrassing. But what went wrong? It's a noble idea, and why did it not work out? I'd love to know.
It would have been great to
see some fiction on that.
Maybe if that could have been explored a bit more in the film, I would have liked that.
Maybe it fell down with, maybe it was just the idea of a Federation president who had it, like here on planet Earth. Good ideas live and die
and they get given up on, and then you're left with
think about it like in the America in the '50s was, optimistic and looking to the future, and in the '60s they were looking to, put people on the moon, and now the world's more, realistic, but
it's just different.
It has to deal with more immediate issues. So maybe that's what happened with the Federation. I don't know. But the Paradise City was put together because the president of the Federation really like that song by Guns N' Roses. I'm gonna build Paradise City on Nimbus 3, and I'm gonna resurrect Guns N' Roses to play there. Their skeletons still exist.
Yeah,
Axl Rose's skeleton it's just full of heroin and bourbon, but we can make it work.
I actually quite like the look of Nimbus 3 as well. I like the Paradise City. I don't mind that it is a little bit Star Warsy. I mean, it looks pretty cool. They realised that well on the budget that they had. I mean, I read that it was a big old set that they built.
If you want to recruit a rebel army, this is the place to go. Mm-hmm. You got Cybok, you got Osama bin Laden, Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, note to self, never let
Obi-Wan Kenobi was in a cave, and then he re-engaged a generation to fight an empire, right?
Wow. Yeah. Jesus, Osama bin Laden, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I would watch that TV show.
All got beards. Cybok's got a beard.
That's true. Yeah. All charismatic.
Let's just throw Brian Blessed in the mix.
Or wear robes.
I really like the characterization. Considering Shatner wrote and directed this, it's really surprising that actually there's quite a lot of moments for the rest of the crew, you know, when you consider it compared to something like, say, the motion picture. Sulu gets a little bit to do. Chekhov is seen in command, and he's doing this whole distraction thing with Cybok, but he's actually commanding the ship. And I would love to have seen that maybe expanded on.
Yeah.
Scotty and Uhura have this lovely moment on the bridge, and you kind of think, oh man, there's something going on there.
Oh, Uhura, I thought you were on leave.
And I thought we were supposed to be going together.
Oh, I can't leave her now when she needs me the most.
I had a feeling you would say something like that. So I brought us dinner.
Oh, Lassie, you're the most understanding woman I know.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm kind of like, actually, I'm a bit in favour of that. I would like to have seen that storyline expanded.
I feel like that was something that maybe they were going to do more of.
It feels like an element of the script that was sort of left in from an earlier draft where there was going to be a payoff to that or something like that.
But it's a little bit of a thing. I would like to have seen that go further.
I'm not sure that I would have liked to have seen that on screen go further.
Yeah, but I like the idea of them getting together. I think that would have been a nice thing.
I'm a Scotty Uhura shipper, definitely.
I'm gonna stand up and say I don't think we've seen anything of that in the past that's made it convincing.
Yeah, but we're at a point now where, you know, things are going along and they're going to look to each other at that companionship and they were going to go, yeah, and actually they've not had massive roles before, so maybe you have to kind of say there's probably some stuff going on that we didn't see because we don't see a lot of them, and now the sun, they're going to come forward and this is going to shine a little bit. And
fair, they've been shipmates for a long time and maybe,
and I think
saving the whales, yeah, it brings people together.
I think Scotty needs a strong woman like Uhura to sort of, you know, keep him in line, because, you know, if a slight incident happens caused by a woman, he suddenly hates all women.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know,
considering
he's
still,
he needs someone to help him.
Complete apathy towards women. He's doing all right.
Yeah. He needs someone to help him get around the ship, because he's always hitting his head on stuff.
But I
agree with you on all the other points, re-characterisation, and in fact
it's
would say
everyone gets a little bit of a moment, certainly way more than they do in motion picture, and depending on it, you know, maybe other films, like it's probably the most Uhura's had to do, except possibly in 4. Everyone got a mission in 4, which was good, but I kind of think that continues, that everyone's got a little bit of something to do,
right? And I would actually argue that this is the real strength of 5, and this is maybe what I enjoyed about it the most when revisiting it, is the real warmth between the characters and the chemistry.
Oh, God,
any scene with Shatner, Bones, and Spock, you know, those three famous characters, any time when they're together, it's just great.
Well, this is one of my notes that I think the film really reinforces the Holy Trinity.
They did
so well. You know, they're on leave together at the thing, and they have these very interesting moments when McCoy talks about Kirk's risk taking and that Spock's like, and that sort of back and forth, and they go through it. And I think, well, obviously Shatner wanted to write them going against him, and then they didn't want to. I think that the fact that they don't works so much better, because it does reinforce that so well, and that strength of those three. And it's almost like, you know, when they have that conversation about, You know, other men have families. Why do we, you know, we spend all that time in space together, and then we spend our shore leave with each other? And it's like, because, you know, actually there's just that you are, you're just like irrevocably bonded together, those yeah. three.
They are like a family. In,
yeah.
In that's this, and that that's the thing that's very, very prevalent nowadays in shows, where they, there's a group of people who aren't related, but they form a bond.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's a nice idea. I mean, I agree. I really liked all this stuff with the main Enterprise crew. I thought it was all the stuff at the beginning with Yosemite.
I love that stuff.
I think that's my favorite stuff. It's great. Like Kirk doing his rock climbing preempts what Tom Cruise did in Mission Impossible by like about 10 years.
Yeah.
Or maybe a little bit, but it's really well filmed as well. It's beautiful to look at, and
I agree. I think there's some great shots in that early. I think Shatner's got a real eye for the for some
and reading behind the scenes. It seems like the only weakness I think of what William Shatner was trying to do is that maybe he didn't delegate very much. Perhaps in terms of making the film, like he took control of. I mean, I know that he kind of was very involved in getting Larry Luckinbill to play Cyborg.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's like he saw him on in a show or something and cast him.
And I just the only thing I can think is that maybe Shatner wanted to do too much.
Mm.
And trying to do that, and with everything else that was going on, some things got missed out. But in terms of how it's directed, I thought it was perfectly well directed. There's nothing about it that I thought in terms of the direction that I didn't like.
Well, I think there are problems that they had on that production that
I think there
even
were
a seasoned
issues,
director
yeah.
would struggle with.
They couldn't get the effect house they wanted. Yeah. They couldn't get the time they needed. They couldn't get the writer's strike kicked in.
Yeah,
it was almost a cursed production. You could think from all these issues.
They had problems with the ending, and they went to they needed more money for the ending. Shatner couldn't get more money for it, so they had to make do.
I think
what
they've
got.
Yeah.
Those are sort of problems that.
David Fincher had that with Alien 3, right?
Yeah,
I think so. I think actually the film has no business being as good as it is considering all that lot.
Mm.
And it's good. It could be better. It could be more finished. It could be more
definitely.
Polished. But do you know what? I can sit there, I can watch that, and I can really enjoy the crew's interaction. I can really enjoy the Kirk Spock McCoy relationship, because I think it's maybe at its strongest in this film.
I agree, and what's
they just work beautifully together.
Yeah.
They are together. They annoy each other, but down at the end of it, they are just so bonded.
The stuff with them, Cyborg and McCoy, is great.
So
we're talking about the euthanasia scene.
That's probably McCoy's best. It's the best scene he has in any of the movies.
I think DeForest Kelly's maybe an unsung hero, and the fact that he's acting is incredible there.
Yeah.
And sadly, actually, Spock's pain scene is kind of lackluster in comparison.
Mm.
But then, if you look at it with the eyes of what I was saying regarding, is this Cyborg getting sloppy? And it's not Spock's pain, it's what his perception of Spock's pain would be, you know. So actually, is it lackluster because Cyborg's doing it wrong, if you like? And maybe that's a deliberate thing, whereas obviously McCoy's is full on, this is a pain he's carried. And you can see how that could actually influence his entire life, his medical career, his excessive drinking. He's got a problem, you know.
My dad always liked beans with bourbon in them, and that's what I gave him to kill him.
But then actually Kirk gets a great follow-up line to that when Cyborg goes to Kirk and Kirk says,
"Damn it, Bones, you're a doctor. You know that pain and guilt can't be taken away with a wave of a magic wand. They're the things we carry with us, the things that make us who we are. If we lose them, we lose ourselves. I don't want my pain taken away. I need my pain."
That's a great moment. That I really like that idea.
I think maybe the that's a good point. But the thing is that maybe a film isn't long enough to a character like Cyborg, his ideas, the thing about a character like him is that his ideas seem good in principle, but ultimately you realise that they're not, and there's a more of an insidious quality to them. Like a character like him is essentially saying, I know you better than you know you, so let me control your life and you'll feel better. And the film doesn't have long enough for that, for someone to be able to realise that and be able to counter it and make other people realise it too. You need to kind of defeat that rationale rather than kind of shoot a fake alien guard with a Klingon disruptor.
Can we indulge in a little bit of speculation for a moment?
Oh, please.
What would Kirk's pain have been, do you think?
Surely it would be City on the Edge of Forever with
Edith Keeler. I was going to say David. I was going to say not being able to stop David's death. And that would have been a really easy one for them to do because they would have the stock footage from 3.
They love using stock footage. They trudge a lot of that.
Should we just give Star Trek 5 points for not reusing that damn Genesis sequence again? That's interesting. Yeah, Edith Keeler is probably a really big one. But also, I think David's a recent one as well, so I think that would still be a pain.
Mm.
And maybe both his absence from David's entire life and then as soon as he gets into his life, his immediate loss, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that is brutal. I always think I can't believe they did that in Star Trek 3.
It is kind of, you look at it like that, you're just like, damn, that's harsh as.
Anyway, we're on Star Trek 5.
Yes, sorry. Yeah. Indulgement over.
I something I really enjoyed about 5 when we were revisiting it. Some of the sequences, some of the action sequences, I actually really like. And I don't know if this is because, and this might be another reason why I like Star Trek 5, is that I realised when I was watching it again that I watched it quite a lot when I was a kid, and it was probably one of the first Star Trek films I'd seen more than once.
It was exactly the first Star Trek film I ever watched, because I'd got into Next Gen, and then I think my mum and my brother had gone to the video rental place.
Yeah,
I remember that.
And they brought back Star Trek 5, and I was like, what, brilliant, that was the first one I watched. So it's kind of a little bit out of context, but it didn't matter too much. I wasn't reliant on having seen others.
Yeah.
But that was my first exposure to the original crew. Mm.
I might have been the first Star Trek. I think I saw the motion picture first.
No, motion picture was my next one, because then I got that for a following. I got that on VHS for another birthday.
It's good that we picked the best to start with.
But then I got two.
Yeah. I remember watching Star Trek. You know, at the end of term, sometimes when you're at school, you'd have like, you'd be able to bring in board games and stuff. And at our school, they'd put a film on that you could go and see. And it was Star Trek 5. Oh. What a treat for the kids. Look at this, some 60-year-old men running around trying to find God.
A lot of the...
I think we were in the 50s, I think.
I think
a lot of the Attack on Paradise City is actually really quite good action sequence.
Yeah, I think it is. And you know, I really liked Spock's rocket boots when I was a kid, and I became quite fixated on the scene where Kirk falls off
El Capitan,
and Spock kind of takes a dive to go and save him. I think that's a good looking back at it,
it's quite clearly on a wire, because it flips. There's clearly a centre of gravity right in his midriff, so that's clearly where the wires were attached to his belt. But it doesn't matter, you know.
No, when I was a kid, I didn't see that. I was just like, rocket boots. Oh my God, rocket boots. I actually really like that. The next rocket boot scene where they use the rocket boots to fly up the lift shaft.
There's a really nice bit where they climb onto Spock.
Yeah.
And they kind of hug each other.
Yeah, yeah, and then they can't take the boots, can't take the weight.
And people know about that scene because it indicates that the Enterprise has like 80 decks or something.
The deck numbering is awful and terribly off and bugs me a little bit, but I just try and put past. What I do like is as they start sinking, it appears we're too heavy, and I think someone says must have been all their marshmallows.
It appears we're too heavy. Must be all those marshmallows.
And it's just a really nice little humorous throwback.
I kept thinking I was mishearing it. Marshmallows. Is marshmallow a trade name?
Well, I read it was I think there was a scene that was cut, or there was a reference that was cut. So I think the idea was that at the beginning, McCoy would have gone into the ship's database and changed all of the references to marshmallows. From marshmallows to marshmallows, because he knew that they were going to go camping. And if they were going to go camping, Spock would thoroughly research the camping trip, and he would you know, come across the idea of tasting marshmallows. And McCoy thought it'd be a hilarious idea just to mess him up.
Yeah,
and that's why he calls them marshmallows.
In the novelization. Which...
Right.
Yeah.
But it's. It's an oddly,
because there's no context to it. It's be like, what the fuck is he saying, marshmallows?
Yeah.
I am preparing to toast a marshmallow. That'll be there. A marshmallow.
And like you say, I thought I'd misheard it, and it wasn't until I was reading about it that.
But I do like those little. I hate to use the word banter, but they almost like those little
bants.
Yeah, these little throwback humorous bits, like, you know, marshmallow and marshmallows, all in the Nimbus City attack. Spock, yes, Captain. Be one with the horse, referencing the be one with the mountain thing. It's just like, oh, it's... and it's again, it's just the element of their relationships. It's so nice.
And I actually really enjoy that pretty shoddy looking shuttle crash sequence.
I love the shuttles. I think it's bold they made so much use of shuttles in there as well.
They do a lot.
And yeah, when it's landing in there, it's like, boy, that's a full one. It lands. The back door opens and they all burst out. I was like, damn, man.
So on the commentary I listened to, they're pretty disparaging of that effect sequence and how it doesn't work because the speed of the shuttle as it comes into crash when it's a model doesn't match up.
Yeah.
But I actually think it's a really good sequence, and the kind of the idea and the music's really, really great in that sequence, and it's well acted, the actors sell the idea. I think everything else sells that.
Minor glitch in the speeds. I like the whole thing. I think
it's a nice idea. It's not a space battle. It's like
seeing shells.
Yeah, cool. There's a ticking clock element with the Klingons arriving.
It's a very tense sequence.
Yeah,
literally where Uhura says Klingon bird of prey bearing a bunch of numbers. You see the bird of prey sweeps into cloak, the shuttle surges forward, and then because they crash in, and then Chekhov's like, the Klingons fire, Chekhov's like, warp speed, and it shoots away. And honestly, if the effects had been done by ILM, that would have been a perfect fucking sequence.
Yeah.
But even with the effect, you know, they didn't take me out of it that much. It's very paced nicely. I like it. I really enjoy it. So.
And I kind of brings me on to another point. The film, it's fun. I think, like, we've talked about some of the humour that they brought in that doesn't quite work. I agree with that, but as a result, it's not po-faced.
No, it is fun.
It does have a sense of, it's entertaining.
Shatner clearly has a sense of humour that's a little bit different
to
anyone involved in the previous films. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's nice to have something new, something a little different. Some of it pays off, as I say, some of the interactions between the crew and throwbacks to previous statements in a humorous way are very well done. Others, like, I know the ship like the back of my hand, less so.
Yeah.
Well, I don't mind that.
I think the weird thing is, I find it demeaning to Scotty, but I also recognise it's quite an iconic piece now. So, sort of.
It certainly seems like that's what they based Scotty on for the Kelvin. That's the moment they base his character on for the Kelvin.
So in many ways, it's quite damaging.
It's a bit Three Stooges-y, but I don't mind.
It's okay.
There's a bit where I like that his kind of rapping computer friend, and that's it, like red alert.
Yeah.
He doesn't moan about that. He just moans that the ship's been built by monkeys.
Yeah. But I also like that it's a film that it does have a bit in common with the motion picture. As we've said before, it's maybe not an action movie. It's kind of it's having a go at trying to do something a bit thought provoking and different. And I like that Cyborg isn't a villain by the end. You actually have some sympathy for him, and particularly at the point where he realizes that God isn't God, and that he's maybe what he's devoted his life to is, you know, it must have been pretty devastating to realize that he's got to Shakari and it's not what he thought it was. And you're kind of with him at that point, and that's sort of different to what we've seen in Star Trek films in the past. And it doesn't, I mean, the ending isn't great, but it doesn't end up with a punch up.
No,
it ends with something a little bit different.
Yeah. I do also like the when I talk about the whole reinforcement of the Trinity.
Mm.
It's the thing that Kirk says in the campsite about he's always known he'd die alone, and then there is that moment when Scotty can only transport two, so he says to him without hesitation, take up Spock and McCoy, and McCoy even protests in the beam, and then of course he can't be beamed up, and you're like, damn, he is alone, and he obviously thinks that. But then there's that point of the Klingon swoop by, and like when he says to Spock, says to him, "Yeah, you were never alone." I think a little bit afterwards on the Enterprise, when they're looking out of the viewport, and they're saying about Spock losing a brother, and what Kirk's response is, "I lost a brother once," and he sort of, I think he's supposed to think he's talking about his actual brother, but he's obviously talking about Spock, and it's just like, yeah, he's sort of. It's very sort of quite touching scenes, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm. Oh, I'm sorry. Before I don't want to finish without saying that General Cord is fantastic. The big Klingon guy is amazing. I like him starting up this drunk, washed-up general, and his glory days are long gone. But then when it's a go to shit, a little bit of encouragement from Spock, and he steps up, and he's like, after by the end, you're thinking, damn, actually, if he had been the Klingon captain, Kirk would have been in trouble big time.
Yeah.
And kind of like, man, actually those two facing off ship to ship would have been cool. But,
yeah, that would have been pretty cool, actually.
And I actually think some of the problems that they had in production makes me warm to the film a little bit more. Like, it's kind of endearing. You know, they really did try to deliver something that they maybe could never really have delivered on, and I can't help but be impressed by that. And I don't think Shatner did a bad job of directing.
It's not just that they couldn't deliver on the concept; they chose it too hard. There was other stuff that really did scupper their work as they went along. You know, the strike, the effects issues, and everything. So, I think, especially when you consider that film is a huge achievement that they never got bloody made.
Yeah.
So the fact that actually it's an enjoyable watch.
I think so.
Don't get too caught up in the minutiae of bits and bobs. You know, and yes, the effects are maybe have issues, but you know, it's just window dressing at the end of the day, isn't it? You can see what things are supposed to be. It's not like you can't make out that ship is the Enterprise, that ship's a bird of prey, that's a torpedo. It's all there.
Yeah. And I've got to say, I watched this on a Friday night. I wasn't too excited about watching it. Set myself up with a couple of drinks. My lady wife, Gemma, had gone to bed early. I was in a good mood. The weekend was approaching. I'd put this on my big screen, and I got in our little garage, and I just had an absolutely lovely time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Friday evening too, and I had a similar experience. Mm. It was just I was thoroughly entertained the whole way through. There wasn't a point where I was like, kind of lost interest or anything.
No, it's good. I just find it so much more enjoyable than maybe peer pressure has led me to believe I should.
I think it's
I
a
say
lot.
Screw you, peer pressure.
I feel like I watched it, peer pressure got in the way, and then I watched it again, and now I know how I really feel about it.
Yeah. I think it's a lot warmer than, say, Nemesis. And it's not as there are things about Generations that really frustrate me, that I don't have with five.
Mm.
And it's kind of because it feels like Generations had a lot of potential, and it was maybe a missed opportunity, the whole Picard and Kirk hookup. But the
that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah. But also, five feels like an original series episode that it maybe not a particularly great original series episode, but it captures that feeling of the original series, I think.
If you want to get, there's no point getting caught up in the little technicalities of, oh, Center of the Galaxy is too far away and bits like that, because, you know, the original series contradicts itself every other week.
Yeah.
You know, you establish a canon, it's very difficult with some of those episodes. So essentially, you can just sort of slightly retune some lines to your personal head canon and work it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just find it a very enjoyable watch now, and I'm really pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed it. And then when you think about it, I'm amazed at how much I enjoyed it, because it had no business even being finished.
Yeah.
Really? So.
So how do you think, in your sort of ranking of the Star Trek movies, has revisiting Five repositioned it for you?
I think it really has. The more I think about it, it's shut up quite a lot, I think.
Yeah. Same here. I considered Five to be the worst just because thought that was always the case, but I hadn't really just kind of revisited it and rethought about it, and I prefer it over Nemesis, and I think I maybe prefer it over all of the Next Gen movies, barring First Contact.
I was
gonna say First Contact's great.
I don't know in terms of the first six, I'd probably now rate it above four in my personal thing.
Yeah.
So it's overtaken an even number.
I just find
four a little bit of a, I don't know what I find. The idea of watching four doesn't fill me with particular glee.
Yeah, no,
three is one which I need to revisit again now. I think three is the one I've watched the least, so I don't know how I feel about three.
I enjoy three.
Two and six. Obviously, two and six are the ones I've watched the most. And I love the most, so they will always be my top two. The more I watch the original series films, the less I. The more critical I am of the next
gen. Yeah, the more I hate everything else.
So I think I like Star Trek V more than First Contact. First Contact.
What?
But we watched First Contact recently, and the stuff with the holodeck annoys me more. I have more of a watching First Contact more recently, I'm looking at the film going, why didn't what are all the people that live where Zephyr Cochran lives doing when they're putting together his ship?
Yeah.
And why are they holographic? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I do like First Contact, but I think it has as many problems as Star Trek V does. I think maybe Star Trek V has a bit more heart to it, because it's doing better with those problems. Maybe
I'd agree. I think emotionally, I felt it, Star Trek V worked for me more.
I think maybe
you make a really good point. The thing I like most about a film is that when you get a sense that the people making it are trying their best.
Yeah,
you get a real sense that they're trying to tell this story, and that's a sign of a really good film. And you go, well, this film. It falls short in some ways, but you can always tell that they're trying to tell this story. They had this idea, they did the best they could with what they had. Like we've said, pretty much all the characterization in this film is great. Like it's always heartwarming. Mm. Lots of the scenes between them progress those characters. It just has a lot going for it. Like it's very likable. Like it's.
Have we redefined this film? This movie is the plucky little film that could.
I think
it's the greatest Star Trek film that has ever been made. Move over, Wrath of Khan. Fuck off, Undiscovered Country. I'm going to watch Star Trek V 13 times, and I'm going to ignore all of the other Star Trek. No, I'm not going to go that far. It's definitely a film with problems, but I don't know why, but I'm more willing to forgive Star Trek V of its issues than any of the other stuff.
I find its issues ignorable, and it's the rest, what's left underneath, to be fun.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I would even go so far as to say that I have a little bit of love for Star Trek V. Just a little bit of love. Yeah, that's right. Lay from my heart to it.
Would you go camping in Yosemite with it?
I would love to go camping. I'd eat marshmallows.
Bourbon and beans.
Bourbon and beans. Yeah. I'd sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat.
Do a round of Row, Row, Row Your Boat.
Then I'd climb up El Capitan and maybe fall to my death.
He'd be in his rocket boots and he could go like, "Ooh!" And then,
I don't trust him to do that, man. There it is.
Oh man!
I don't think you'd have that much control over the rocket boots.
No, I wouldn't be great with rocket
Spock's
boots.
Spock's good with them. I don't know.
Yeah, he has a certain Vulcan strength, agility, and grace which I lack.
I didn't want to say it, but there it is.
No, you can say it. I think that concludes our defence of Star Trek V.
Yeah.
I think we've come out of this thinking that Star Trek V is pretty great.
The greatest.
Seriously, steady on with that shit, man. You're scaring me.
I'm sorry.
It's well worth rewatching if you're still not convinced by this clearly well-researched podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Just watch it for yourself and see what you think. But yeah, I would definitely say if you were like us beforehand, we were kind of pretty critical of it without really knowing why. Watch it again and see what you think, because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
And open your heart to it.
Yeah, watch it on a Friday, have a few drinks.
Yeah.
We're not saying you have to be drunk to appreciate this film.
But it helps.
But I mean, I think that maybe that is a big part of...
Well, I wasn't drinking when I watched it, and I enjoyed it.
Have some bourbon and beans.
Yeah. So, I think we can leave it there. I think we've really covered it, haven't we?
Yeah.
What does God need with a starship?
Bring the ship closer.
I said, what does God need with a starship?
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, our website is www.lowerdecksradio.co.uk. You can reach us on the Twitters at 10backward, 10 being the numbers 10 and backward being the word backward. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/10backwardpodcast, and you can also email us at crew@lowerdecksradio.co.uk. on a personal individual level, my Twitter is @nerdrick, and I believe you two also have Twitters.
I do. Mine is @WillTurland.
Mine is @MrImhotep, MisterImhotep.
So please do get in touch, give us any feedback, or suggest new episode topics, anything like that.
Let's make sure that history never forgets the name.
10 backward?
Daddy, don't you think you should rephrase that?
10 backward. 10 backward.
Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Row, merrily, row, merrily, 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 life is but a dream.
Merrily, merrily, merrily,
your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream.
Merrily, 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 life.